this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. I'm your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C. Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff, the top thug and enforcer of the regime, someone who makes no secret of his contempt for Obama himself at various points. So this all-powerful chief of staff, far beyond the role of anybody we've seen recently, beyond Panetta or James Baker III or McLarty or any of these characters, Rahm Emanuel. Now, the research that Wayne Matson has put together, to which I am indebted for this general overview, goes like this. Rahm Emanuel has become obviously very controversial lately because of series of articles attacking him and defending him that have come out in the press. And it started around February 20th with this article by the Washington Post, Dana Milbank, praising Emanuel, saying Emanuel has been right on all the main issues and Obama has been wrong. Obama's a bungler. He should listen to Rahm Emanuel and not be distracted by his groupies, essentially the swooning brigade of Axelrod, Gibbs, the spokesman, and Valerie Jarrett. And that was followed up then by another article in the Washington Post, and that is by Jason Horowitz. Obama's enforcer may also be his voice of reason, Tuesday, March 2nd. Now, the praise of Emanuel is countered by articles by Leslie Gelb attacking Rahm Emanuel, Michael Moore calling for the ouster of Emanuel. He volunteers to go there himself. Ed Luce of the Financial Times, The Guardian, Steve Clemens from the Left Foundation milieu, Jane Hampshire, Fire Dog Lake, Grover Norquist, whole bunch of people attacking Rahm Emanuel. So he's very, very controversial. And the question is, can he be fired? And I would say, yes, he must be fired. And here's the thing. This is a brutal political enforcer, a psychopath from many points of view. This is the guy who sent a dead fish to an enemy. This is the guy who plunged his knife into the table repeatedly in 1996, promising to make dead, to kill, in other words, a whole series of political enemies of Clinton at the time. And, of course, Emanuel puts the whole Clinton White House back in into perspective. It's thought that Rahm Emanuel may have been the guy who hired Miss Lewinsky into the Clinton White House. But right now it is a vendetta. A lot of what you see going on the surface of politics has to do with an underground vendetta by Rahm Emanuel against his political opponents. And that is to say, anybody progressive, anybody in the left wing of the party, anybody who is anti-Wall Street, anybody who is pro-labor, anybody who is concerned about the black community, anybody who is critical of Israeli foreign policy, all of these people targeted by Rahm Emanuel. Now, the spectacular thing we've had this week, Congressman Eric Massa of New York forced out. Now, the beginning point of all this, forget all the fluff, the salacious stuff and the fireworks, because the guy has been intimidated. The starting point is Massa says he was threatened by Rahm Emanuel, jabbing his finger at him and saying, you better support the Obama health bill. Massa had voted against it. Massa had been out there. He was second perhaps only to Grayson and a few others as the idea of a firebrand Democratic leftist not happy with the sellout to Wall Street and the insurance companies that was going on. So Emanuel, according to Massa, forced him out. Emanuel used the House Ethics Committee and related processes to essentially force Massa out of office. This is what is essential. Forget all the other stuff. Forget all the salacious nonsense that many people focus on. The starting point is a direct attack by Rahm Emanuel saying, if you're a critic of my policies, I will force you out of the U.S. House of Representatives. And then we turn to the problem of the Black Caucus, obviously not happy with Obama. We have an article in the Washington Post today, March 12th, Black Caucus frustrated but reluctant to say so. Lawmakers think Obama should be doing more for African Americans, but they won't criticize him. Well, They won't criticize him because they are under attack by Rahm Emanuel. Another dimension of the vendetta, it's not just Massa. It extends to the Congressional Black Caucus, and it is that Rahm Emanuel is organizing a reign of terror there. The first person to feel the effects of this is the top black committee chairman in the entire Congress, Charlie Rangel of Harlem, the head, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Brought down, of course, in every politician, you're going to find some violation of some law here and there, greater or lesser degrees of corruption. This is not essential, because you can say that about all of them. They're all dirty in that sense. When something like this happens, why this person, why now, who is doing what to whom? And in this case, Rangel forced out through a campaign orchestrated behind the scenes once again by Rahm Emanuel. The next chairman, the Black Caucus, has four committee chairmen, four important committee chairmen, and 18 subcommittee chairs. Rangel is out. Who's next? John Conyers, House Judiciary Committee. Important, because impeachment begins there. Conyers' wife has now been convicted and sentenced to jail time for an alleged corruption scandal in Detroit. And we have a whole series of attacks on black elected officials in the Detroit area. Kwame Kilpatrick and his mother, who I think is a congresswoman, is also under attack there. The idea being now that there will be an attempt by Rahm Emanuel to extend the conviction, essentially the demonization of Conyers' wife to Conyers himself to force him out. Then we have Benny Thompson. We've talked about Benny Thompson here in the last couple of weeks. This is the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. Remember, it was in response to questioning by Benny Thompson that we had Patrick Kennedy, the Undersecretary of State for Management for Consular Services and Visas, who volunteered this interesting information that the Christmas Day bomber, Mutalab, kept his visa because a U.S. government agency demanded that the visa not be lifted because they were following him, they had eyes on him, and so forth. This is obviously not going to endear him to Rahm Emanuel, because this points out how false and how hooked up and orchestrated this entire thing was. Benny Thompson, thought to be under imminent attack for various kinds of campaign finance or gift violations. So Rangel out. Conyers, wife convicted, targeted. Benny Thompson also targeted. Another chairman, of course, Adolphus Towns of Government Operations. We'll see what happens to him. Dingell, Congressman Dingell of Detroit, forced out. Now, this was one of those critical points where the Democratic Party meets the labor movement, always targeted from the days of Harris and Williams down to today, right? Abscam Brylab back during the Reagan administration. Today, Rahm Emanuel is doing it. So Dingell is out. And Henry Waxman is in. This is the main issue here is, are you interested in having industrial employment in Michigan, or are you going to be a global warming freak? And Waxman, whatever his other proclivities, is a global warming freak. By the way, Gallup poll, 48% of Americans believe that climate change has been exaggerated. So you go through the Black Caucus, Rangel, Conyers, Benny Thompson, add in Massa, add in Dingell. We'll get to more targets in a minute, but a reign of terror, a night of the long knives by Rahm Emanuel. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Vendetta, the night of the long knives of Rahm Emanuel, an attempt to purge all authentic opposition elements from the Democratic Party structure, in particular in the House of Representatives. Targets have included Congressman Charlie Rangel of Harlem, ousted as the head of the all-important House Ways and Means Committee, out the tax writing committee. Next on the list will be Congressman John Conyers from Detroit, immediately targeted in the wake of the conviction of his wife and the sentencing now of his wife this week for various nefarious activities, which can be real or not real, but that's not the reason that this is going on. Congressman Benny Thompson of House Homeland Security, also targeted, especially because of this latest incident where he was instrumental in getting the word out that the Christmas Day bomber had been deliberately let in to the United States. We're watching the case of Adolphus Towns at the Government Operations Committee. We're also noting Dingell forced out, congressman from Michigan, longest serving, most seniority, direct connection to Detroit auto industry and the union. Somebody was going to fight for industrial employment in Michigan, the Midwest, and more broadly. Notice Congressman Murtha, now deceased, died in the wake of a gallbladder operation at Bethesda Naval Medical Center. Murtha was also targeted, right? The ethics accusations against Murtha had to do with the fact that he, like Dingell, these are the nodal points where the Democratic Party meets what's left of the trade unions. These are the things that the Wall Street characters like Obama, Emmanuel, Geithner, and so forth always target. Before we leave the Congress, let's look at Kucinich. Now, remember, Massa was targeted because he was the only ally Kucinich had in opposing the Obama health care plan. So far, Kucinich has been hanging tough. Pressure on him is tremendous. People should encourage Denny to fight this issue through all the way. He was on TV this week saying that he would oppose the Obama health care plan. We have Marcos Melitzos Zuniga, the unspeakable cost of daily costs. The CIA trainee, Melitzos Zuniga, has come out with his usual vile filth, probably inspired by foul-mouthed Rahm Emanuel himself, attacking Kucinich, saying that Kucinich deserves to be thrown out through a primary in the Democratic Party. Sorry, Melitzos Kos, CIA trainee. It's too late this time around. The primary was already in the first week of March, and Kucinich won it against a well-funded challenge. So Kucinich is still there, but his only partner in saying no publicly in the way that he did to the Obama health plan, Massa, is now out. Let's also look at the case of Congressman DeFazio of Oregon, who is in many ways one of the programmatically best people in the House, also courageous, the one who talks about a Tobin tax or a tax on derivatives, at least under some conditions. We know that Obama himself threatened Congressman DeFazio, saying, "Don't think we're not keeping score." In other words, we see that you're voting against us, and we don't like it. So, Rangel, Conyers, Benny Thompson, Kucinich, Massa, DeFazio, Dingell, and the late Murtha, all under attack. Now, it's broader. Let's look at the case of the New York governor, Patterson. Patterson now under attack because of alleged ethics violations. Who's orchestrating the scandal behind the scenes? Who is giving it the oomph and the drive? Rahm Emanuel once again. And here is a plan that you can see how Rahm works hand in hand with Wall Street. The designated replacement for Governor Patterson of New York is this guy Ravitch. Ravitch, now the lieutenant governor of New York, and Ravitch is promising draconian austerity. Maybe we just go through this at this point. The New York Daily News this week published the Ravitch plan to deal with the tremendous budget crisis in New York, which is on the same lines as California and Illinois. The Ravitch plan is he wants to become governor. He wants to balance the budget in 5 years. He wants to engage in high-interest bond borrowing, read MAFO bills, high-interest bond borrowing in the same way that Arnie Schwarzenegger did in California, increasing the debt burden at high interest and helping to bankrupt the state. Ravitch is demanding a receivership board, or this is what Rohatyn is demanding and Ravitch is expected to carry out. A receivership board essentially means a Big Mac. Big Mac, Municipal Assistance Corporation. That is the vehicle by which Felix Rohatyn seized control of the budget of the city of New York in 1975 in the New York City budget crisis when Ford said drop dead to New York City. The Rohatyn, Ravitch, and Rahm Emanuel want to go back to this, the receivership board, the Big Mac, in effect. So the receivership board would be essentially really the ultimate authority, apart from, you know, above and beyond the state constitution, in open violation of the state constitution. This situation would now be that the governor, in this austerity dictatorship that's planned, the governor of New York would be able to restore a balanced budget by decree. In other words, he could unilaterally revoke actions of the state Senate and the state legislature, override them in the name of financial discipline. The legislature would be stripped of many of its powers. The state constitution would be overridden. And if the governor didn't do it, then the oversight board, the receivership board, the new Big Mac would be able to do it. Notice, there's no talk here of making Wall Street pay. All that huge amount of money, the greatest money, river of money in the world, is going through Lower Manhattan, and there's no idea that you could tax that and do something to for the sake of the city. So you're essentially subsidizing Wall Street at the expense of every other person, man, woman, and child in the city. So this is another one. Now, that combination, Rangel, the most powerful black congressman losing his post, and Patterson, the first black governor of New York, one is Rangel is out, at least as committee chairman, Patterson about to fall. This has caused a big, obviously big political crisis in Harlem. Let's also look to Illinois. Blagojevich, most indications now backed up by Wayne Manson's research that Blagojevich was driven out by Rahm Emanuel, and that ultimately that negotiation that was going on was the difference between Blagojevich wanting to control the nomination for Obama's Senate seat and Rahm Emanuel demanding that he would control it, and the result, the frame-up or something like this of Blagojevich with the help of the corrupt prosecutor out there, Fitzgerald. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Remember, check tarpley.net for my books, which are indispensable for following all of this passing scandal parade that we've got and the tremendous crisis that we're going into, the second wave of the Depression now upon us, including my appearance on Russia Today this past week, RT, which was about the ginning up of cyber warfare by elements inside the U.S. government. A full treatment of that is available at tarpley.net. So Rahm Emanuel's Night of the Long Knives, an attempt to extinguish any opposition against Wall Street domination inside the Democratic Party, targeting such figures as Rangel, Conyers, Benny Thompson, Kucinich, Massa, DeFazio, Dingell, Murtha, until he passed away, and key governorships, Patterson of New York under attack, Blagojevich forced out, the new candidate, of course, they had this Janulius, Alexei Janulius, a element of the underworld, in effect, through his family bank, unspeakable corruption. This is part of the same Resco machine of slumlords and profiteers that Obama himself comes from. And, of course, the Daley machine in Illinois, Mayor Daley and his brother William, who wanted to be ambassador to China but was not allowed to do that because Rahm Emanuel had this character Huntsman in mind for the post. Daley machine not happy with Obama not happy with Rahm Emanuel, and therefore a lot of tensions breaking out. If you look at Patrick Kennedy's outburst this past week about the fact that the media were covering Massa and not the question of the Afghan war, this is an unstable individual, but he's pointing to something quite real in a somewhat clouded way. What he's obviously concerned about is Massa, and the idea that Massa was significantly an ally of the Kennedy machine, or what's left of it, left liberal part of the Democratic Party, the part that's more likely to be anti-war. Remember, Rahm Emanuel demands only warmonger Democrats. As we pointed out here in 2006, the word from Rahm Emanuel was if you wanted money from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to run for Congress, you had to be a warmonger. You had to be a finish-the-job-in-Iraq warmonger. And that meant that Tammy Duckworth in Ohio got millions to lose, and Colonel Bob Bowman down in Florida, who came close to winning, was denied any penny. He got nothing, in effect. A few hundred thousand would have put him over the top. That would have been another Democratic seat. So look at also the slimy role in all of this of the Daily Kos, and look at the slimy role of Arianna Huffington, the Puffo, as she's known. It's not the HuffPo, but the Puffo, obviously funded by George Soros, one of those speculators who has been the most prominent in attacking Greece through hedge funds and through derivatives. If we look at the forces arrayed, so to speak, based on these articles, if we try to read the tea leaves and see who's on what side, what we seem to see is that on the one side, you've got Rahm Emanuel and his White House machine with significant parts of the intelligence community and AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, plus other interests, significant part of the Washington Post with them. But on the other side, you've got the Clintons. Hillary Clinton hates Rahm Emanuel and does not like working at the State Department, where she takes orders from Rahm Emanuel. The Kennedys, that would be the outburst by Patrick Kennedy that we've just seen. The Black Caucus under attack, and significant establishment elements, because after these articles in praise of Rahm Emanuel, we've got David Gergen and David Broder, the electronic and print media voices of the Eastern liberal establishment, essentially not supporting Rahm Emanuel, but rather inclining to be critical of him. Gergen would be somebody who might imagine that he could become the White House chief of staff if Rahm Emanuel were forced out, in the same way that Gergen came into the Clinton White House after Clinton lost the congressional election in 1994. So he obviously is a candidate to do that. We've also got Sally Quinn, Ben Bradley, right, the old Watergate circles from the Washington Post, not liking Rahm Emanuel as far as we can see. So this is a real fight behind the scenes. One interesting sidelight, just to show the degree to which public events are actually the reflection of underground movements that the average person does not see. This whole question of bringing the Olympics to Chicago was essentially sponsored by Valerie Jarrett and her crew of real estate speculators and profiteers. They thought that if they could bring the Olympics to Chicago, they could make a fortune on land speculation through the Olympic Village and all the rest of this, even though it was a desperate bid. It looked like Brazil with Lula had been locked in as the likely winner. Michelle Obama also went out on a limb to bring the Olympics to Chicago. Land scam in Chicago, and took Obama to Copenhagen. Obviously, Obama profiling more and more as a weakling in this regard. So there we have that interesting story. That was underneath it all was a land scam or real estate speculation attempt. Now, this situation is obviously, it has authoritarian overtones to it. Rahm Emanuel, to whom may we compare him? How about Mussolini? the Mussolini overtones of the Obama campaign were quite obvious, and I pointed to these systematically during 2008-2009. And I warned that at a certain point, the night of the long knives comes. In other words, there's some kind of a backlash. Obama rode the left liberals, the anti-war people, into power. That is how he won the primaries. But then there comes a time, like now, when he's escalating the war in Afghanistan, selling out more and more to Wall Street, selling out to the insurance companies, selling out to Big Pharma, that there's a backlash building in the Congress and elsewhere against this. And if he is defeated on health care, as he should be, this will then turn into a full-scale revolt, and that would probably lead to the fall of Rahm Emanuel. And I've said the only hope to change anything here, as long as Obama's in power, is a total crisis of the regime, a complete catharsis. And it has to begin with the ouster of a whole lot of these figures, starting with Rahm Emanuel. In other words, when you have the cabinet cleaned out, when half of the cabinet is out, when Rahm Emanuel is out and a whole bunch of White House czars and others are ousted, then you will know that something has changed and that the situation has begun to open up. Obviously, mobilize before that happens, but when it happens, mobilize for sure then. The comparison I would make is with Mussolini and the Italian parliament. He seized power, of course, the March on Rome, October 1922, but he didn't have complete power. There was still a king. There was a monarchical establishment that he had to deal with and control. So it took 1923, 1924, 1925, 1926 before you actually had the consolidation of a complete authoritarian and the totalitarian dictatorship under Mussolini. And there was a big phase of conflict with the parliament when Mussolini was changing the laws. He said, if you get one quarter of the votes in the election, you should get two-thirds of the seats in the parliament. And it was a social democratic deputy, Matteotti, socialist deputy, who said no. And he was mysteriously assassinated. So this is the kind of terrain we're getting into. Mussolini struggled with the parliament, Rahm Emanuel's attempt to purge the House of Representatives. Back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So therefore, the comparison is Rahm Emanuel and Obama attempting to purge the House of Representatives, comparable in many ways to the campaign of Mussolini against the Italian parliament in 1923, 24, 25. He attempted to stack the deck with this fake election law, similar to what's going on today, the attempt to pass health care with a self-activating rule that deems that the House passed the bill and then reconciles that. Well, similar to these things that that Mussolini was doing to the Italian parliament. The main protester against this was Matteotti, who was then assassinated by people close to the fascist party. This then led to a secession. In other words, the people who were being driven, being attacked in the parliament, said, we're going to leave the Italian parliament and set up our own counter-parliament on the Aventine Hill, some distance away. And, of course, this turned out to be a disaster, and that was the end of them, and that led then to the consolidation of the full-fledged totalitarian dictatorship. So what we're seeing is a kind of Aventine succession in place. The people stay in the House of Representatives, but they shut up and they don't do anything. So we'll see how this goes. Now, there's a foreign policy angle to this. Obviously, we had Biden in the Middle East this week meeting with Netanyahu and then being affronted by an announcement of 1,600 new settlement homes in Jerusalem this time. But it does, from the international point of view, fulfill the definition of the occupied territories, because that's what that is, until the final status talks. So this was a complete affront to Biden, who then had to come out and say, I condemn what this government has just done. Right? Netanyahu claiming that he didn't know the right-wing or extreme right-wing minister in charge of the housing did it. There's also this strange incident where Netanyahu gives Biden a framed picture of Biden's mother planting a tree there in Israel, in the Holy Land, except that the glass on the picture is shattered, saying, "I have nothing to give you but broken glass." Broken glass, some kind of a coded message, and certainly not good. Now, there's also then the overwhelming economic ramification. If the Rahm Emanuel strategy goes through, and generally this is what's happening already, a tremendous wave of drastic austerity gripping the United States. We went through this Rohatyn-Ravitch plan for New York State. In Kansas City, we've got a large part of the school system, almost half of it, being shut down. Rush Limbaugh thinks that's wonderful. As the fabric of human civilization is destroyed, the Limbaugh types, the Austrians and Chicago boys, the disciples of William F. Buckley, exult because they say, this is big government being dismantled. Yes, too bad. As human civilization goes by the boards. Illinois, Governor Pat Quinn says he's going to cut $2 billion from the state budget in a caustic budget reform, including the firing of 13,000 teachers. In Virginia, $2.2 billion deficit, $1 billion-plus cuts in education and Medicaid with Governor McDonnell, the stealth reactionary, right, the smiling reactionary type, saying, "I am going to fire essentially tens of thousands of teachers," is what it's going to be there. In New Jersey, Governor Christie, using this complete Tea Party anti-government ideological reaction, he wants to cut 2,000 state workers, privatize significant parts of the New Jersey government, and he wants to make state employees pay for their parking tickets. You look at this guy, he reminds me of Hermann Göring. He's the Garden State Göring. He wants to declare a state of emergency and bust the unions by depriving them of their contracts. In California, we have 8 counties where the unemployment has gone over 20% officially. In Michigan, we're over 13.5% unemployment officially. And here in the District of Columbia, 12% unemployment. Now, here's the message. This doesn't work. It's ideological. It's insane. It's lunatic. You cut the budget this time around. You fire state workers, cut government services. What have you done? The taxes being paid by those government workers are no longer paid. Instead, they're going to be drawing unemployment benefits. Your deficit goes up. The local restaurants, dry cleaners, services, all the rest, patronized by those state workers, will then feel the pinch. Tax revenues go down. And the next year, your deficit is bigger. In a depression, budget cuts lead to bigger deficits. This is the stupidity, the cretinism of the Tea Party demand. It's the old Ross Perot demand. Run it like you'd run your kitchen table. It's not the same. In a depression, government activity in general looms larger and larger because of the collapse of the private sector. And that means if you simply remove the government part, thinking that you're going to balance the budget, it's a never-ending spiral into the abyss, because every cut you make comes back to haunt you with lower levels of economic activity, lower tax revenues, and a multiplier effect from that through the economy. Larry Kudlow, the cocaine-preferring commentator there over at CNBC, obviously he wants to shift the burden of the depression to public sector employees. He says we've got to have a nationwide immediate 10% wage cut for all public sector employees. That's what's being done in Greece, where they are under hedge fund attack. This is CNBC. And again, the general idea, there's an attempt to direct the hatred of the masses against public sector workers. Well, that's because they have unions. The answer to the fact that many public sector workers get more than the private sector is, hey, you guys in the private sector, form your own union, have collective bargaining, and you can make a living wage too. It's not to bust the other guy's union. Again, the favorite tactic of the ruling class, is to play one part of the population against another while Wall Street laughs all the way to the bank. And let me remind you, the great example of why this stuff does not work and reminds you in a chilling way of what it leads to is the Hermann Brüning government in Germany, B-R-U-N-I-N-G, or B-R-U with two dots over it, B-R-U umlaut N-I-N-G. The Chancellor of Germany from March of 1930 through the summer of 1932, this was an austerity dictatorship in the midst of the Great Depression. He would write these emergency decree laws, the so-called Notverordnungen. These would be issued under the signature of Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg. That would be our dear friend General Petraeus in the coming years. But Hindenburg would put them out, and those were austerity decrees in a state of emergency. And what was the main thing? Budget cuts, higher taxes, taxes on wages, on income, on sales, turnover, taxes on sugar, on beer, on tobacco, the attack on public sector workers. Public workers were hit hard. State social spending was cut, and in particular, the unemployment insurance fund was targeted by Brüning, and this led to massive increases in unemployment and a growing deficit. And what did it do? It destroyed the institutions of the Republic of Germany at that time, the Weimar Republic. The democratic representative institutions, such as they were completely destroyed by this process of austerity. And that is what these cretins from McDonnell in Virginia to Christie in New Jersey to the Kansas City School Board to Governor Pat Quinn to Ravitch, if he ever gets power in New York State, God help us. They do not understand that this destroys the basis of democratic representative institutions. So austerity doesn't work. Deflation doesn't work. You need an economic program to fight the depression. Start off with a Tobin tax, Wall Street sales tax, and ban credit default swaps. Those are the issues. And check my 5-point comprehensive emergency program to stop the depression at tarpley.com. Austerity against budget cuts. And this is a tendency we see from Greece to Iceland to 100 campuses across the United States. This week, we're recording the show here on Friday, March 12th. There's a general strike going on in Italy today against budget cuts, against austerity, against what the bankers dictate. IMF shock therapy would be another word for it. Similarly, in Greece, yesterday, there was a general strike. So Greece and Italy have general strikes, and the U.S., in our pathetic fragmentation and impotence in the face of the ruling elite, we can't do anything. We don't make it when it comes to fighting for our own economic survival, except that we do have the students coming out on 100 campuses in 33 states saying no to tuition increases. The first step towards rationality and reality is don't make me pay for the depression, make the bankers pay. Now, the students have got to master the second part of that, but at least saying don't make me pay is a beginning. And, of course, in Iceland, we now have the report, maybe we can get a report later in the show, 92% plus voted against the bankers. The vote in favor of paying the so-called debt, paying the extortion and blackmail is what it was, the pure thievery to London and The Hague, to the British and the Dutch, the Anglo-Dutch, was 1.5 to 2% were in favor of paying. But 92 to 93% said, no, we're not paying. The rest of the ballots were invalid or blank. So that's the tendency of reality. Now, of course, the odd man out is the U.S. Tea Party movement, which says, please come and flay us alive. Please strip us of our economic rights. We're concerned about the deficit. We're concerned about future debt. That's all well and good. But in the immediate, as we will see, that translates into a brutal austerity program causing deaths in the here and now. And there's no doubt about it. It has genocidal overtones just as bad as anything that Obama is proposing. And, of course, there's a bipartisan consensus. Republicans and Democrats are uniting to defend Wall Street. And if you don't like that, you better have your own independent organization with no Republican politicians of any kind and no Democratic Party politicians of any kind either. You've got to somehow separate yourself from these two parties. And I guess that's a growing understanding. So Greece, as we know, this is the attack of Goldman Sachs and Soros on the Greek government bonds as a means of attacking the euro. The purpose of that, of course, is to make money in the short run, but also the broader political purpose is to mask the crisis of the U.S. dollar by making the euro collapse faster than the dollar. It's an act of economic warfare. It's an organized bear raid. And, of course, instead of destroying the health, education, and welfare safety net of the Greek population, the government there ought to be striking back against the hedge funds, ban derivatives, or at least ban certain kinds of derivatives. There is a move, and we'll talk about it in a minute, an international move to ban credit default swaps, something we've been calling for here. Banning derivatives or taxing them out of existence, whichever is easier. But certain kinds have to be banned, and credit default swaps are the ones. So that's what we need for Greece, not making the people pay for the crisis, but taking it back to the bankers who caused the crisis. And if you don't have that programmatic element of how you make the bankers pay with a Tobin tax, a Wall Street sales tax, a securities transfer tax, a trading tax, call it what you will, but the Wall Street sales tax or Tobin tax is the indispensable central part of this, plus other reforms, of course. Ban credit default swaps. Ban adjustable rate mortgages. That's what we need for Greece. Iceland shows the way, but now, of course, the Prime Minister of Iceland, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir, says, well, that was one deal that the people rejected by 92% to 2%, but we're going to find a way to pay nonetheless. So the absolute contempt for democracy, for the popular will expressed by these Eurogarks, because that's what she is. This Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir is a Eurogark, a dyed-in-the-wool Eurogark, oriented towards the Tony Blair, Gordon Brown New Labour Party. They have absolute contempt for the popular will, for any kind of democratic expression. As we were told by Thorarin Arnarson last week, this regime of social democrats in Iceland boycotted the election. They refused to go and vote. They said it was meaningless. So what you think is meaningless. And again, if you don't like that, don't hitch your wagon to any Democrats, but don't hitch your wagon to any Republicans either, like you Tea Party chumps out there. When you come to Washington, they take you over to Capitol Hill to listen to a bunch of House Republican reactionaries popping off about how they got religion now and they're off the booze and they're in favor of fiscal responsibility. Well, those are the guys who passed the monstrous Bush tax cuts for the rich, $1.3 trillion in deficit spending, plus the Iraq war, plus the Afghanistan war, all coming as deficit spending, plus other measures that Bush put in. And then the students. Students, you've got to understand it's good to go out and assert your rights, and that's essentially very basic. But we can't spend too much time celebrating that because there's going to be a counterattack. And the counterattack is quite obvious. The Wall Street Journal editorial page, Wednesday, March 10th. California's college dreamers. When will students figure out that the politicians have sold them out? Get it? The usual ruling class finance oligarch line. The politicians are your enemies, not Wall Street. Not Goldman Sachs, not J.P. Morgan Chase, not Morgan Stanley, not the Bank of America, not the people who are actually controlling the government and giving orders to Geithner and Obama. No, it's the politicians. And, of course, the line from the Wall Street Journal is that these are spoiled brats. These are little gluttons of privilege. They're so privileged already. They're out there demanding more privileges. They should bite the bullet and suffer like the rest of us. Well, of course, the only way to avoid that, dear students, is to give your struggle a broader social meaning and to put forward as program points of your own reforms that will meet the needs of the entire society. So you can identify your struggle with the public good and the common weal precisely in the way that the Wall Street Journal does. They say, well, of course, the financiers are essential to the system. So when we bail out Wall Street, we're really bailing out Main Street, except, of course, we're not. Dear students, the only way out of this is to say Tobin tax, securities transfer tax, trading tax, make Wall Street pay. Hit Goldman Sachs in the labanza, where it hurts. 1% coming out of all your trades. You want to do flash trading 1,000 times a second? Wonderful, boys. 1% in the public treasury. So by the time you've done it 100 times, not much left. And that indeed will put a wet blanket over speculation and replenish the public treasury and begin the shift of the United States away from this hyper-financialized casino economy of globalization where everything is betting and wagers and risk, back to the solid area of investment in modern plant and equipment, modern technology, modern capital goods, large-scale infrastructure, science drivers, and therefore real economic growth, not speculative growth. And you can see the freak out of the Washington Post. They're also freaked out about Athens and the, quote, speculators, as if they're not speculators. Well, they are. We'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Of our times, the mass struggle against bankers, against Wall Street, against the City of London, against the International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, the World Trade Organization, all of this. That's the struggle. However, in order to win, you need a program. You must have a program. It's not enough to go with your spontaneous demands, my group should not pay. Got to be broader. What's the reform in the entire society that would include your group, but also the interest of 90 to 95% of the rest of the people, so you can gain support, spread the strike, build a large-scale coalition. It's things like this. Tobin tax on the bankers. Ban credit default swaps. Ban adjustable rate mortgages. Ban foreclosures for 5 years or the duration of the world economic depression, whichever comes later, whichever lasts longer. Now, this week, and it's interesting, you know, we've been raising here the demand to strike at derivatives. Strike now against derivatives. Do something to remove the 1.5 quadrillion derivatives burden under which humanity is groaning. Humanity is crushed under 1.5 quadrillion of fictitious capital in the form of derivatives. So, headline, Wall Street Journal, Wednesday, March 10th, swaps come under fire. And they say, well, it's U.S. regulators and European leaders are looking for more oversight on trades and derivatives. It's more. This is outright proposals to ban, to outlaw credit default swaps. And it's about bloody time. But we have to look at this. This is something that deserves to be supported. In the same way, when the AFL-CIO and Robert Kuttner come out for the Tobin tax, the Wall Street sales tax, we're for it, no matter what reservations we have about these people making the demand. This is the programmatic honesty of you know what your program is, and therefore you can support initiatives not based on what you think about the person, but based on the direction of the proposal, at least largely so. So here's what we have. Because of this outrageous attack by the Soros hedge fund group, and we saw it in previous weeks, right, Greenlight Capital, SAC Capital, Soros Fund Management, Brigade Capital. We saw that infamous meeting on February 8th in the Manhattan townhouse that was reported on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, which I discussed then to some extent on Russia Today. Because of this outrageous use of hedge funds and derivatives with high-level leverage, more than 20 to 1, but starting at 20 to 1 and up, leverage. There's now a worldwide movement to do something about derivatives, and the Europeans are angry because they see that these derivatives have been used to attack them. So we have Jose Manuel Barroso, head of the European Commission. Now, somebody we don't like. You know, if you listen to this program, we know what we think of Barroso. But now, let's listen to what he says. The European Union executive boss says the European Commission would examine closely the possibility of an outright ban on purely speculative trading of swaps. Well, there's already a big exit clause there, right? A big escape hatch for Barroso. We need to ban credit default swaps. U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission Chairman Gary Gensler on Tuesday says he's got offering, according to the Wall Street Journal, his most specific criticisms of credit default swaps. He wants to limit their use, although he did not go as far as to suggest a ban on speculative trading with credit default swaps. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, you know, we think of her too, but that doesn't matter right now. Her government, the German government in Berlin, backing an initiative to curb the credit default swaps market. Germany joined by France, Greece, and Luxembourg. Luxembourg is important because that's a banking center. That place is offshore. So lots of banks in Luxembourg. Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, you know what we think of him, too. But when he came to Washington to meet with Barack Obama, he did not, at least in public, demand any bailout funds from the United States. But what he did ask for was that the U.S. regime curb the activities of these hedge funds and investment banks. Now, this is the hardest sell of all, of course, because Geithner and Obama are owned and controlled lock, stock, and barrel by Wall Street, by Jamie Dimon, by Lloyd Blankfein, by Pandit the Bandit, and the rest of them. But Papandreou said he found a very positive response from Obama on the European proposal to curb these hedge fund activities. European leaders Tuesday encouraged global action from the U.S. and other countries, but they say they will not wait. So, according to the Wall Street Journal article, credit default swaps are now up to $25 trillion. Now, that's lowball. That's still more than the gross domestic product of the United States. It's probably more than the gross domestic product of the United States plus China plus, well, let's see how far we can get. But it's way more than $25 trillion. How do we know? Because we don't know. Because swaps and other over-the-counter counterparty derivatives, designer derivatives, structured notes, are not reportable, thanks to the victory of Bullet Bob Rubin and Greenspan over Brooks Lyborn back in the late 90s in Clinton's second term. We don't know the true mass of derivatives. We just know that it's huge, and we must strike back against derivatives. The $25 trillion comes from the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. That is an enemy alien, my friends. That should be declared an enemy alien under the Trading with the Enemy Act, and they should be sanctioned. They should be vested, in other words, seized. All assets of the International Swaps and Derivatives Association should be seized by the U.S. government. That's the only way it can come about. So the issue of a ban on credit default swaps, one of the most dangerous types of derivatives, will be discussed at a meeting of the European Union finance ministers in Brussels sometime now around, the week of the 15th of March. So maybe it'll be the Ides of March for derivatives. Is that possible? Yes, it's possible. Now, remember why this is so important. Credit default swap is a form of insurance. But the people who were selling these things do not meet the capital requirements and other regulatory requirements of being an insurance company. In other words, to sell insurance, you've got to have a certain depth of capital. You've got to have backup systems, reinsurance, and all the rest of it. Credit default swaps, it's done by the seat of the pants. There's no thought of tomorrow. These are purely speculative bets. And that's, of course, why AIG London, with their $3 trillion of derivatives, mainly credit default swaps, has so far cost the U.S. taxpayer $200 billion or more, the most expensive or one of the most expensive parts of the entire bailout. And we remember that about a year ago, Senator Warner, in Senate hearings, asked Bernanke, should there be a bright line prohibition of credit default swaps? And Bernanke said, I can't rule it out. We'll consider it. Well, don't hold your breath. Fight to ban credit default swaps and tax other derivatives out of existence. Back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Now facing, obviously, the second wave of the world economic depression. There is a political upsurge. It can be thought of as a mass strike upsurge, especially in the more recent manifestations, because what we've seen from Greece to Iceland to the U.S. campuses is essentially labor and students. That is a serious mass strike process. What we saw last year in the summer, the Tea Party revolt against Obamacare, is a petty bourgeois or Pujadiste form of resistance. At least that is what it has become. Not surprising. In a mass strike, the ruling elite obviously tries to pit one part of the mass strike against another on class lines. So in this case, it's to take these Tea Party characters and dupe them and turn them into a battering ram against labor, against students, against minorities, the inner city, and indeed the majority of the population. In other words, you want to take part of your labor movement and make them into strikebreakers. That's essentially the story of SEIU. So we're in a bad fix in terms of leadership and organization, and since that is so, you will see that the tendency, therefore, is to split. Let me just point your attention to an interesting article in the New York Review of Books this past week, which is an infiltrator in the Tea Party. And what is not understood about the Tea Party is now that the authentic part of this has been winnowed out. The authentic part was a lot of people who went to those town hall meetings last August were there to say, don't cut my Medicare. Don't cut $500 billion out of my Medicare that I've paid for. Hands off my economic rights that come to me through the New Deal, the Great Society, and the New Frontier. Don't do it, Obama. Don't destroy my Medicare in the same way you're destroying the Kennedy space program, and in the same way that your subservience to Wall Street makes a mockery of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Now, of course, those people were pushed out. Those people were shouted down by the loudmouths who turned out to be Republican operatives from the Heartland Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute of the ultra-reactionary Richard Mellon Scaife, and, of course, Dick Armey and a whole gang of Republican lobbyists and astroturfing consultancy groups. So what you have left is essentially a group of petty bourgeois reactionaries who are ready to be used as strikebreakers, and there's no other way to look at it. The New York Review of Books article is this guy who gets into the Tea Party, goes to the Nashville Opryland Convention, and he's surprised by how many of the Tea Party people are rich elitists. How many of them are well-heeled, cosmopolitan, practically socialites? He talks to a couple of people at the Opryland, and one of them had been in Tuscany at their farmhouse in central Italy, and another one had a sloop in the English Channel, and practically a yacht. And naturally, you see what the interest of these people are is they are rich people who don't want to be taxed. Simple as that. But they mask that in the rebellion against Obama. And, of course, that is the danger of Obama, is that, as I've been pointing out for 2 years, Obama makes this kind of thing very easy. Because if Obama serves Wall Street, the Republicans and reactionaries can sit on the sidelines and snipe against that and call it big government. If Obama started to attack Wall Street, you'd see the Republicans immediately lining up in defense of Wall Street, and a lot of these other characters would be doing it, or they wouldn't be in action. So the high prices, the Opryland location, and so forth show that what's left of this Tea Party thing, also with the Fox News sponsorship coming in, I would say the authentic elements have been pushed out. They have been disenfranchised. They've been silenced and isolated and driven out. So that what you call now the Tea Party is essentially a perversion of the intent of many of the original people in it, and it is now available for reactionary use. The problem is that these are such strident reactionaries that when the Republicans have them out as their first wave, that will cause a corresponding abreaction in the rest of the society, who are horrified by what these Tea Party characters are proposing. Because, of course, we have Congressman Ryan, the budget expert of the House Republican Caucus, who wants to destroy Medicare and destroy Social Security. Yes, indeed. He's a traditional reactionary Republican. It's the same note we've seen since the 1930s, 60 to 70 years of reactionary Republicans, Roosevelt haters, all trying to destroy the New Deal. And that is what Gingrich said. He said, everything in my life is basically an attempt to chip away at the heritage of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And we would add of the mass strike process of the 1930s, the Toledo auto light, the Detroit sit-down, the general strikes in San Francisco and Minneapolis and so forth, the labor upsurge that actually gave you mass institutions, which the Greeks still have, the Italians still have, but have been destroyed in this country. And that's one of the reasons that the standard of living is falling, and also that public life is so stupid, because there's no institutions that would fight back against the banks. The banks seem to control everything, of course, including the weakened unions at this point. Now, the next stage of the depression, the foreclosure wave. Washington Post today, March 12th. Foreclosure wave threatens stability of housing market. Millions more delinquent. And what this essentially comes down to, 5 million to 7 million properties, mainly homes, are potentially eligible for foreclosure, but they have not yet been repossessed and put up for sale. And part of this is simply that the repossession and foreclosure system is clogged. It's overloaded. The banks are foreclosing as fast as they can, but their system is, for the moment, overwhelmed. The number of pending foreclosures could grow much bigger over the coming year as distressed borrowers become delinquent, and then if they can't obtain mortgage relief, wade through the foreclosure process, which often takes more than a year to complete. The percentage of U.S. mortgages that are 3 months or more delinquent is up to 9.67% in the fourth quarter of 2009. Comparison, in the first quarter of 2005, 1.89%. So it's gone up by about 500%. This is a depression. It is a depression, a world economic depression of inconceivable proportions. It is bottomless. There is no business cycle. This is like the cargo cult. This is the tooth fairy and the Easter rabbit. There is no business cycle. You don't get out of a depression until you change policy, and radically, and back to the New Deal. Mortgages were, properties were seized by J.P. Morgan Chase. It peaked in the middle of 2008, fell steadily during 2009, but are now doubling up to 45,000 homes in the fourth quarter of last year. So that's the thanks you get from J.P. Morgan Chase for being bailed out by the taxpayer. 45,000 people thrown out. Now, we take the upper-level figure, 7 million. How many people does that mean? Well, multiply that by 3 to 4. What's an average family? What's an average home? How many people live there? We're between 21 million and 28 million Americans, persons, who are going to become internal refugees. They're going to be thrown out on their ears. They're going to be on the street with their furniture piled up. They're going to be living in Obamavilles. The new Hoovervilles, of course, are the Obamavilles. That's a world economic depression. The answer, stop beating around the bush. Ban foreclosures. Outlaw foreclosures. Stop them now for 5 years for the duration of the crisis.
The GCN Radio Network. Providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Mentioned last Saturday, the people of Iceland voted overwhelmingly, massively. It was a massive repudiation of the banker's dictatorship, which is essentially the predominant form of government in the Western world, in the U.S., Europe, and Japan. But here we have Iceland, population 1/1000th of the U.S., 330,000 people on this island at the top of the North Atlantic, and they say no, nay, to the bankers. Now, we want to go back to our correspondent there in Reykjavik, Thorarin Einarsson, and see what's happening now in the aftermath. But before that, Thorarin, can you give us a kind of a first-person account of what it was like on Saturday, Sunday, when the voting was going on and when the results came in, and some color commentary on the ground, so to speak?
Well, it was kind of a bit surprising that the no was over 90, or about 93%, more than we saw in the poll. So, of course, people were very happy about it. But, you know, during the day, people were in a good mood. They were marching down the street and having a protest. And in the night, we just saw good results. It turned out that the people who were going to say yes, they rather, you know, stayed at home instead of voting. So that is maybe the explanation. We only got, you know, less than 2% saying yes, but there were actually people who actually did.
So, Robin, what was the turnout? How many, what was the percentage of those who voted compared to those who didn't vote?
Yeah, it was 63% that showed up. So
that's more than you get on anything here in the U.S.
Yeah, I guess it's perhaps common ratio in Europe, in European referendum. It's, of course, less than an usual parliamentary elections. But, of course, many people got the message from the Prime Minister and Finance Minister not to vote and just stay at home. Like they did, the finance minister and prime minister, they declared they would not participate. They would stay at home.
Well, now in the wake of it, what has emerged? In other words, we know that Johanna Sigurdsdottir, the prime minister, the social democrat, the Eurocrat, Eurogarch, she wants to come back and try again. She wants to find a way to pay. What is she up to?
Yes, of course. She is still in that mode, but I think the people of Iceland are really things in the course. That, there was a poll recently that said that 60% of Icelanders just absolutely don't want to or don't think it's right that Icelanders pay anything. And
right.
But of course, Johanna is still, you know, going the way to Europe, to the EU, and she just wants to comply. like the government in general. So they will do anything. But I feel now that there's a different atmosphere on the way. That, for example, I just had a meeting last night where people are thinking to organize a conference in a group to change the constitution, you know, on their own, to have, you know, great meetings where people come together and actually change the constitution by themselves, and then get it changed that way, from their own effort. And I think this kind of thinking is getting more apparent now.
Gorarin, let me warn against this, because reforms of the government process, formal reforms of government, are generally a diversion from the real issues at hand. In other words, if you're going to spend time organizing, I would strongly recommend get out there with a program that says, make the bankers pay. We won't pay is number one. Make the bankers pay Tobin tax, 1% tax on banking turnover, derivatives, stocks, bonds, and all the rest of this stuff. Make the bankers pay for the crisis, and then join, now that we have the Greece crisis going on, join in the European effort to say ban credit default swaps. So certain kinds of derivatives can be taxed and you get money for the public treasury. But other than that, credit default swaps, these so-called insurance policies, they have to be banned, outlawed outright. And we just heard that even Barroso at the European Commission, Merkel, Sarkozy and others, they're all demanding an end to credit default swaps. Now, that would be concrete, right? Rather than say we're going to change the Constitution, which takes forever, and ultimately it's not going to work.
Yeah, but the thing is that what is good about it is that it really motivates people, and it's a part of the process that people are feeling that not only that they have the power, but they have to sort of use it and, you know, take it in their own hands. It is something to be a part of, and it will be important. But also these what you suggested has been we have the attack here in Iceland promoting these kind of ideas.
And, Who promotes them?
No, I mean we have, you know, the organization ATTAC in Iceland.
What is it? Tell us.
No, I mean the ATTAC is an international group that is promoting, for example, the Tobin tax and re-regulating the financial system. And I think it's a pretty big group here in Iceland that is has funded the Icelandic ATTAC group, and it recently went to Norway, and they had actually a meeting with the Norwegian government, which, by the way, now is changing their position on the ISAF, that they are willing to give loans, disregarding the outcome of the ISAF dispute, and that's a big change from before.
I'm just recommending. What you need now is a direct attack on the bankers. In other words, not the reform of government so much, but the attack on the bankers, so that you're actually essentially waging a class struggle against the bankers. Mobilizing people to fight bankers is the main demand of the hour. And changing.
Actually, I should say that the we have made this kind of attack. That there is now people on, you could say it was a pay strike. People who have stop paying their debts, and as a group, it's a group action, and also people are encouraged to take out their money from these specific banks, the big banks, and get it to smaller banks or saver banks. And this actually started last February 19th, and this could also grow momentum, this kind of action.
Let me point out, though, that what you need is a mass movement, that is something which brings people together in an organized form, not something that you do alone, not something of isolated people moving bank accounts from one bank to another. This is, frankly, not very radical. This is at the level of Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post. But something where you say, bankers, I'm going to strike at you directly. I'm going to do something against you.
Yep.
Collectively.
Sorry, I had some problem here with the kids.
We understand perfectly. Thank you, Thor Aaron. Hang in there.
Okay.
You come back.
Come.
Anyway, I'm recommending that what you need to do is find organized forms of resistance against bankers.